2002 Salt Lake Sandstone Symposium presents session number 235, Book of Mormon Archaeology, North America, a paper presented by Wayne May, with a response by Terry O'Brien.
This is the area that we're talking about, starting over here with Iowa and Missouri, right down the Mississippi, and going right to Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, and the main state of Michigan. Upper Michigan is very important, which you're going to see just in a minute. And, of course, New York, Pennsylvania. In the Book of Mormon, if you read and understand carefully what's going on, the Lamanites are constantly pushing their Nephite counterparts from the west and from the south. And so they're getting squeezed into that what the red line represents. And, of course, to the north are the many waters. So you've got the water boundaries to the north, the wilderness to the south, and they're being pushed in that direction, headed for New York or the end of the whole book. So let's go on. Next one, please. Okay, Jerem 1 and 8. We multiplied exceedingly and spread upon the face of the land and became exceedingly rich in gold and silver and precious things and fine workmanship of wood in buildings and in machinery and also in iron and copper and brass and steel and etc., etc. Now, the reason this is so important, one of the key things you must keep in mind, if you watch carefully, when you read your Book of Mormon, the principal building materials are wood and copper, not stone. Wood and copper, and I can't emphasize that enough. Also, wherever the Nephites landed, they had to have all these things available to them. Now, in North America, there's two highly mineralized areas in this country. One is Utah, right here, and the other one is the Great Lakes area of Middle America. Next one, please. This right here is called the Upper Peninsula, and you notice this is Wisconsin over here. I personally do not recognize its political boundary. I call this Mishcon up here. This is it should have never happened, but that's another story. Anyway, Upper Peninsula of Michigan right here. This up here is called the Keweenaw Peninsula. Now, when the Jesuits came in here in the 1600s, they saw that Native Americans had a lot of copper. Well, right away, they're looking for mineral wealth, and they asked the Indians where they got the copper. The Indians brought them to this entire peninsula. Now, on this peninsula, they found, and then up until the 1800s, when our European ancestors began to mine this copper, on the Keweenaw Peninsula, they had over 5,000 ancient copper pits. The oldest date is 2,174 B.C., which again is a nice fit for our Jaredite timeline. In the Book of Ether, we're told the Jaredites heaped up great heaps of earth to obtain copper. And we have the mines here fitting the timeline for the Jaredites very, very nicely in the Great Lake area. Also, the Hopewell culture continued the mining operation, and we know that because we find the copper from the peninsula throughout the Hopewell burials throughout all of Middle America. And the reason we can trace it is that this copper is the only copper that has silver in it. If it is not smelted, the silver strain will be remained in the copper and can be traced. And it's identified here as Keweenaw copper. The other thing about the copper that made it so special, unlike the Kennecott mine here in Utah, which is an ore, an aggregate, you have to pound and separate to pull the copper out with the other things, this copper in Upper Michigan is already smelted. It's already refined. It's pure. Mother Nature did it. Under Lake Superior is a solid copper bowl. And believe me, if we had a way to get it out, they would have figured it out by now, but they can't. It's just too costly. But the copper is up here. It's just, I can't even tell you how dense and how abundant. Even today, there are guys up here we call prospectors that make their living going through the woods of Upper Michigan just finding copper veins and loose copper cell there from the glaciers, and they pick it up freely. Next one, please. This here is known as the Ontonagon Boulder. It is solid copper. It weighs 90 tons. This was at the mouth of the Ontonagon River, and it was found its way. The Europeans saved it, the early miners, and it went into a museum there in Upper Michigan, and finally now it's in the Smithsonian in Washington. You can go see this today. It's still intact. Notice up here these little, what I call, spall markings. These are places where they've actually pulled chunks of copper off this large ingot. And when it was found, it was still sitting on cribbing raised down in the earth. It hadn't gotten to the surface yet. They were working their way up by levers and jacks of oak to get it to the surface and then push it off the hole. The mines themselves were no more than 30 feet deep. They would dig a hole 30 feet deep, take out all they could, get rid of the riffraff, and then they would leapfrog to the next spot and go down and dig another 30-foot hole. That's what peppers the Keweenaw Peninsula, over 5,000 ancient copper pits. Next, please. Here's some example of their work. These weapons here are found anywhere from Wisconsin, Michigan, all the way to New York State, Ohio, Illinois, hardened copper weapons. I personally have over 1,000 pieces of my own collection. You have to have a metal detector, and you got to know where to go look to find them. They're on the rivers and the lakes of Middle America. and they're marvelous pieces. They're hardened copper. I have them on display in the room we're at downstairs. If you like to stop by and see them, there's plenty to look at. Next one.
How hard to hold that copper yet?
Well, I can't tell you. I don't know how hard, but I'll tell you what. You can't bend it. It's tough as steel. Tough as steel. Here is a copper breastplate. This is what they find on the mounds of the Ohio when they remove and look for the artifacts and the bodies. This would actually be a breastplate that would cover your entire chest cavity area. It's on display at the Ohio Archaeological Museum in Columbus, Ohio. And they're very common. There's a lot of them. Next one, please. Here's an example of their copper working, the Hopewell culture. They were very, very well-crafted. They were artisans, and this is what sets them apart from the other cultures. That's why the archaeologists know that sometime after 400 A.D., this culture ceased to exist because they don't find the artifactual evidence in the layers where they look for them. So they know that these guys were no more. Next one. Ohio itself is what I call Hopewell Central. And the reason for that is because of all the sites that are there. In the state of Ohio, you can see the red back there from your chairs, it represents habitation sites. There's over 1,700, and this is considered to be a minimal estimate. Also, there's 534 what we call enclosures. Now, the enclosures, they come in many shapes and sizes. We're going to take a look at that real close. And the archaeologists here today of Ohio, this is a new dating, they've got them covered 800 B.C. to 500 A.D. Again, a nice, lovely fit for our Nephite timeline. Let's take a look at Ohio a little closer. Next one. This is the most common enclosure. You'll find these next to the rivers. This white line around here is the earth berm, just like in the Book of Mormon and Alma. The earth berms can be anywhere from 5 to 35 feet high. The black line on the outside is the ditch. So this is a ditched earth berm. It has a few openings to get in and out, and it's always close to water. The river is right here. This is the most common. Next one. Then you find Alma talks about places of resort or a place to flee onto. These are the hilltop forts. They would find an outcropping of a hill, and they would use the natural lines of the hill. This represents elevation, all this shaded area. This is anywhere from 300 to 500 feet from the valley floor, and they would run wall of stone and earth all the way around the edge and turn this into a place of resort or a place to go to in time of trouble. Hilltop forts. They're all over Ohio. Next one, please. And then these are called the geometric works. These represent high math. They represent excellent surveying techniques. These people were highly skilled. And we'll talk about this just in a minute. What's really interesting about the geometric works is that their dating falls between 100 and 200 A.D., which, again, is a wonderful fit for Book of Mormon, simply because that was the golden era after Christ had come here, that 200 years of peace. To build something like this, you had to have stable economy, a stable culture. So you had to have mass population. These things are absolutely huge, and we'll come back to them just in a minute. Next one, please. Alma 49, 4 and 5. But behold, how great was their disappointment, for behold, the Nephites had dug up a ridge of earth round about them, which was so high that the Lamanites could not cast their stones and their arrows at them that they might take effect. Neither could they come upon them, save it was by their place of entrance. Please keep that in mind. We're going to demonstrate this. The place of entrance is very, very key, because this was designed by Captain Moroni to force the Lamanites to fight on their terms. And the Hopewell culture has mimicked or copied that same thing. Now at this time, the chief captains of the Lamanites were astonished exceedingly because of the wisdom of the Nephites in preparing their places of security. Next slide. This is out in the woods. This is a 30-foot berm with trees upon it. Next one. Here's another wood shot. Again, I'm on top of the berm looking right down it. Trees growing on it today. They're all sloughed off. Next one. Here's a road at a park. This is at Fort Ancient. This also is about a 30-foot berm right here. And they use one of the openings to go through for a road just to pass through the park as you make your tour through it. It's a lovely park, Fort Ancient, to go to. Next one. This here is a geometric earthworks site, and this is the berm. Again, notice the straightness of it. Now, when the archaeologists cut through the berm to find out how this was constructed, they found out that this thing was engineered. Different gravels, different clays, types of soil. This wall was not just thrown up loosely with a bunch of dirt. It's an engineered wall. And because of that, it's withstood the test of time, and with its age, it's stood up very, very well. Today, this is a golf course. Next one. Alma 49, 18 through 21. The Lamanites could not get into their forts of security by any other way save by the entrance because of the highness of the bank, which had been thrown up, and the depth of the ditch, which had been dug round about, save it whereby, again, the entrance comes very key. And thus were the Nephites prepared to destroy all as such should attempt to claim to enter their fort. by any other way, by casting over stones and arrows at them. Down to 21, and it came to pass that the captains of the Lamanites brought up their armies before the place of entrance, and began to contend with the Nephites to get into their place of security, but behold, they were driven back from time to time, insomuch they were slain with immense slaughter. So, what we have here, we got the highness of the bank, we've got the ditch, and the Lamanites are fighting the Nephites at their chosen point, the place of security, place of entrance. Next one, please. Here's an example of an earthwork. This is a 30-footer. Here's the ditch out here. By the time you get to the bottom of the ditch, you're probably talking about 40 feet. Again, keep in mind, this is filled up through debris and rot and erosion over the years. This thing is still in good shape today. Right now, today, this is a footpath on the edge of Newark, Ohio. Runners use it to jog on. You can see the path here. And again, this is the outside. Here's the ditch, up the bank, top of the earthworks. Okay, next one. Again, another shot here. Here's the outside. Here's the big ditch, bank of earth. This is the top of the wall. Of course, there'd be a wooded stockade along here as well. Next one. Here's an example, and appreciate how deep the ditches are and how big the walls. Here's the berm, all the way to the top, all man-made, all in Ohio. 534 of these in Ohio. Okay? Next one. Yes, they do. We're getting there. Alma 50, 2 and 5. Upon the top of these ridges of earth he caused there should be timbers, yea, works of timbers built up to the height of a man round about the cities, and he caused that upon those works of timbers there should be a frame of pickets built upon, and they were strong and high, and he caused towers to be erected that overlooked those works of pickets. He caused places of security built upon the towers, the stones and the arrows, limits could not hurt them. Okay, next one. This is Fort Hill. We're going to demonstrate the towers. We're looking right down on top of Fort Hill. This is a hilltop resort, a place of resort. Notice these little black lines. These are openings. These are breaks in the wall. There's 33 of them. The place of entrance is right here. This is the main way in, main way out. The whole embankment is 2 miles, encloses 40 acres. It's 500 feet up from the valley floor. It's Hopewell construction, 300 BC, 500 AD. We're going to take a look at these openings now. Very important. The archaeologists tell us these openings must be all doorways. They've christened this as must be some kind of a sacred site, so people could come in from all directions and into this sacred enclosure. The problem with that is, if you could really see this in person, how steep this is, you'd say, there's no way this is a doorway. There's one door, and it's right here, place of entrance. Next one. This is inside that fort. Here's the earthworm coming around. Now, right here is a break. It's because of the trees, it's very difficult to shoot these things. Here's a break right here. This is one of the openings. It's a big wedge V. Next one. Here's another one right here. Here's a big berm. Here's a break. Another break right there. Next one. I'm standing in one of the breaks here. They run anywhere from 14 to 16 foot in diameter. And can't appreciate the depth here. This is going up. This is up. I'm down in a literal hole right in the wedge of the break, standing in that wedge. Next one. As the archaeologists have cleared away the debris and rubble on the berms, they found what's called post molds. This is what's left behind from the rotted timbers. They've also found that these timbers have gone down by fire as well as just rot. And this is the four types they found to this date. These are the wooden towers that stood in those 33 openings at Fort Hill. Towers. Also, some of the towers are coated with a cement-like material, either for decoration or most likely to retard fire. A cement material on the walls themselves. Wooden towers. Next one. This here, I put this in to show that when the Europeans first came into the Canadas and in upper New York, they found that the Iroquois Nation, they were still building their cities and putting circles of wood around them. They had walls just like they had in the Book of Mormon. And the key thing is here, the hole was lined within to the height of a man. Still building the same way as the Book of Mormon. I found it very, very interesting. This comes from Francis Parkman, Jesuits in North America, page 29. Next one, please. This is looking down from the top on the geometric works that are still in Ohio. Most of the time, not always, but most of the time, if you would pass through an opening, you'll see a berm right inside. And there's a reason for that we're going to get to just in a minute. And occasionally, there is no berm inside. We don't know why they didn't do that, but this is how they look. All these different names, all these can be looked at today. They still exist throughout Ohio. Next one, please. This is standing outside of a geometric works. Excuse me. This is outside right here. This is the berm on the outside. Now, here would have been your wooden towers on the outside of the berm. As you'd pass through the opening, here's your berm on the inside. And this also would have had the wooden towers and the pickets constructed on here, again, forcing people to go through in a good gateway to watch for unfriendlies coming through. Next one. This here is Fort Ross. We're going to take a look at this one here. It's in Butler County. We're going to focus on this right here. This is place of entrance. Notice, here's your elevated area. This is a hilltop of resort. Here are three smaller entrances to probably flee the fort if it falls, because they're not main ways to get in. This is definitely the place of entrance. One way in, and we're going to talk about this right here. Here's a close-up. Okay, now, the Hopewell people, they'll be inside here. Their attackers will be coming from the outside. They'll be coming right out here. As they approach this, they run to the first embankment. Then they have to swing to the left or to the right. Again, there's wooden pickets on this earth berm to defend them. So as they squeeze through the bottleneck here because of the bank falling off, it becomes slow movement. They become easy targets. They make the turn. These guys come through here, make the turn. They both meet right here. Again, a bottleneck squeeze. As they pass through the opening, they come into here, and they've got three choices. One, two, and three. And no matter which way they go, they're still in trouble. These guys are really bad off because they got to make that big swing, and they come over here. Again, the whole time they're running through here, people in the towers are letting them have it. It's everything they got, okay? Arrows, rocks, stones, whatever. And finally, they make the turn, and they come right up to here, and who's standing here? The fresh army of the defenders ready to meet the attackers. And meanwhile, because they bottleneck them up right here, the guys who are doing the attacking still have to protect their heads with at least one arm, because they're getting hit from above, so they've only got one arm to fight with. But the defenders standing here in the opening, they can use both arms plus the help from those who are in the towers letting them have it. This is a killing field. I believe this was designed by Captain Moroni. This is a typical example of the Hopewell fortifications in Ohio. 534 of them. Okay, next. This is Stone Fort. This one here happens to be in Tennessee, and I want to show you they did exist in other states. We're going to focus right here on the place of entrance. The walls here go almost all around, but then they have a real high cliff face, so they stop because it's just impossible to climb here. And here again, the wall picks up and goes all along here. We're going to focus right here on place of entrance. Next one. Again, this is the place of entrance. Next one, please. Here's the archaeologist's sketch from Manchester, Tennessee, where this resides. There's huge stone pile of earth and dirt here, stone pile here, also earth and dirt. One here, one here, one here, one here. This is the place of entrance. And, of course, here's your walls, again, forming a narrow passageway in. Next one. Here's an artist's recreation. Stone tower, 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 tower. And again, forcing the enemy to run this gauntlet before they get to the point of entry to hold them off. Military defense. Next one, please. Here's an overview from the top. The red are the attackers. The blue are the defenders. They've got to pass through here, through the ditch, continue on down, getting hit all the while as they pass through, and again, and here's your defenders waiting to meet them nice and fresh on the inside. Okay? Place of entrance. This one's in Manchester, Tennessee. Now, Manchester, Tennessee, the wall construction, they've gone down and picked up the post molds right here. This is where the logs were inserted for the vertical timbers. Here they have a dates of 30 A.D., 230 A.D., and 430 A.D., This site was inhabited by the Hopewell culture for over 400 years. They've got the dating, and again, it's a nice fit for the Hopewell timeline. Okay? Next one. This is a typical Hopewell mound. You could find usually only one person buried in here. They average in height from anywhere from 6 to 30 feet. Occasionally, you'll find what's called an intrusive burial beyond the side from a different culture that comes later. And next one, please. Here's an example of a bundle burial where they're put up in the trees and allowed for it to decompose. They're regathered, they're scraped off, the bones are put in the mounds, and then a ceremony is held for the deceased. Next one. You also find the flex burial, which is more common. You'll find the guys stretched out here, burial goods, pottery, their points, little jewelry, whatever. And this is more common. But then occasionally you will find, as described in the Book of Mormon, what I call, and the archaeologists call, battle mounds. Verse 11. Nevertheless, after many days, their dead bodies were heaped up upon the face of the earth, and they were covered with a shallow covering, and now so great was the scent thereof that the people did not go in to possess the land of Ammonihah for many years. So the point is, in the Book of Mormon, big battles, lots of dead, heap the bodies, throw earth up on top of them, create a big mound. And the question is, how big are these mounds, and do we find them? And the answer is, in the Midwest, Missouri to New York, Wisconsin to Florida, we find this type of mound structure. And this is what it looks when they take the dirt off. This right here. This is a battle mound. No ceremony, no burial, no care. This one here happens to be men, women, and children mixed. So whoever these people were here, this was genocide. It probably cleaned out a whole village area, maybe a small town. Everybody here has a blow to the head with a blunt instrument in their skull. This is atypical of the Midwest. Battle mounds. Next one. This here is the Zelph Mound, if you know your story from the Zion's camp march with Joseph and the brethren. They camped on top of the Zelph Mound. The mound is actually huge. This is just the tip top. It goes 300 feet down to the base of the river. Illinois archaeologists have cut through the mound, and they've estimated 1,000 men are buried in this mound. 1,000 men. Now, Joseph and the brethren, of course, removed the top fellow and said he was Zelph, the white Lamanite who fought for Onondagas. Again, Onondagas is not in our Book of Mormon. We get this from Joseph and the early brethren in their journals. This is Zion's Camp March. This one here is at Griggsville, Illinois. It is owned by the state of Illinois. You can go there at Griggsville. It's not far from Nauvoo. So if you go to Nauvoo, I'd recommend you get out your map and find Griggsville and drive on over. It's been identified by the locals who have lived there all this time. When you drive into the state park here, the park rangers, they also have it marked. If you walk in, just say, "Where's the Mormon Mound?" They'll point you right to it. Okay, this is Griggsville, Illinois. Griggsville, Illinois. Okay. Also, within a half a mile area of this mound, there's also 120 more mounds. Six of the mounds of that 120 are also this size and stature, which tells us there was one heck of a big fight here. During the Hopewell timeline, 300 BC, 400 AD, we don't know when it took place, but sometime there was one heck of a big fight here on the Illinois River, not far out of Nauvoo. Next, please. Okay, don't mind the artwork, it's mine. This is Ohio, in case you haven't figured it out. This is Indiana, this is Illinois. Anyway, this is Kirtland. Zion's Camp March starts at Kirtland, and they just run across all the way to Illinois. And when they get to the banks of the Mississippi, Joseph Smith writes a letter to Emma, which has been published in Deseret in 1984 in a book, and we're going to show you this and see how many people have seen this one. We arrived this morning on the banks of the Mississippi. We left the eastern part of the sea of the state of Ohio, the whole of our journey in the midst of so large a company of social, honest, and sincere men wandering over the plains of the Nephites, recounting occasionally the history of the Book of Mormon, roving over the mounds of that once beloved people of the Lord, picking up their skulls and bones as proof of its divine authenticity, and gazing upon a country, the fertility, the splendor, and the goodness so indescribable. Joseph Smith, Jr., letter to Emma Smith, June 4, 1834, author Dean C. Jesse, The Personal Writings of Joseph Smith, page 324, Salt Lake City, Utah, Deseret Book, published in 1984. How many people have seen that before? Okay, it's about normal, four or five. These are the things that I hunt for and that I look for. And I tell everybody, stay close to Joseph. Next one. Joseph was accused, of course, as you're well aware, of writing the Book of Mormon and fabricating the entire book. We know about the Spaulding papers. We know about the book, View of the Hebrews. All these things were thrown in Joseph's face. However, it was really, really nice. There was a lot of things in detail that Joseph gave about these people that were not in those works of the Spaulding or the View of the Hebrews and other things that they claimed of the day. This here is called Marietta, Ohio. These faint lines are the streets and the city blocks of Marietta today, Marietta, Ohio. And this was a huge Hopewell city. The red, these four things in red, are all that's left of the earthworks that are still there. However, the important part is that this was excavated after the Book of Mormon had been published. And the information that came out of here really helps, in my opinion, to vindicate Joseph in some way. The men they took out of here were in copper armor. They had gold and silver ornamentation on their bodies. One guy had an iron sword, which crumbled to dust upon picking it up. And one man, about a mile away from the site, still attached, because the mounds are over here on the ridge, this side of the river. These are mounds, and they continue right around here. Had a steel bow in his burial. Now, all this was removed in 1841. And, of course, the first thing people ask, well, where are all these things? Well, they went out to private people. They went out to collectors. And I can tell you this. When they cleared the ground around the Hill Cumorah in New York State, they found many implements of iron. Some they recognized. Some they did not. But the journals of the early pioneers of New York tell us straight out, the iron was so good, they re-smelted it down at the local blacksmith shops, and they put it to good use on their farms. Artifacts. Okay, next one.
Do you know if they've done any kind of testing for DNA or any of those types of things on the bones?
We'll get there. Alma 62:20-23. Now, I'm not going to read all this, but I'm going to tell you what's going on here. Tiancum has been killed. Captain Moroni lost the city of Nephiha. They want it back. It's nighttime. The Lamanites captured the city with tremendous cost. And now the whole Lamanite army is camped on the place of entrance. And now they're going to wait there for the Nephites to come in, and they're going to give it to them, because they've lost a lot of men at that place of entrance. So they're so busily camped there, they don't even put guards out. Because on the opposite side of the city, Moroni tells us here, he takes cords and ladders and ropes and lets his whole army down inside the city undetected, and they wait till dawn before they surprise the Lamanites. Now, I first read that, I thought to myself, my gosh, how could a fort be that big? How could it be that big for a whole army to go undetected, climb over the wall, opposite end of the walls? It just didn't seem possible until I examined the cities of the Ohio. Next slide. This is the city of Newark. This is one of those 534 places, just one. This area right here, walled and ditched all around ancient Newark, is 4.5 miles. You go from this octagon circle earthwork here down to this circle as a crow flies, that's 2.5 miles. So as far as I'm concerned, yes, if somebody was camped on one side at about a 4-mile distance, they could sneak over undetected if they were that sloppy and posted no sentries, which obviously is what happened. It could take place. The Native Americans call this place City of the Prophets. Newark is very, very special. And we're going to talk about a couple of things. Today, all that's left is this octagon and circle and this big circle right here. Everything else is pretty much gone. The city.
Where?
Pardon?
Newark.
Newark, Ohio. Next slide, please. This is an aerial shot of Newark. Here's the big circle. Here's the octagon earthworks. Anybody recognize what this looks like? It's a golf course. How many golfers in here? Okay, you can't tee off till 11 o'clock, but between 8 and 11, you can go there and walk the grounds any day of the week, okay? And if you go to Ohio, I recommend you stopping by. Next slide, please. Here's another shot of the circle. Here's the clubhouse right here. Can you appreciate the size of this thing? Look how perfectly surveyed and defined. Remember now, this went up between 100 and 200 A.D. Time of peace and prosperity in the Book of Mormon history. The geometric works. These are not thrown up just carelessly. Engineered walls. Next one. Now, just to make sure you can appreciate the size of it, the green area here is that earthwork you just saw. The circle and the octagon. This yellow thing superimposed on just the circle. Anybody want to guess what that is? If any of you are subscribers, you can't answer the question. I know there's a few of you here. Anybody?
Pyramid of
Kemos. It's Pyramid of Kemos in Egypt. So now you can appreciate the size of these things. They're huge. And they are also laid out with purpose. They're not just laid out randomly. They're lined up with the heavens. When to plant, solstice, the equinox, when to harvest. Okay, calendars. Next one. My good friend, Dr. James Scherz, University of Wisconsin, he's an engineer, he's a surveyor. He and a Mr. Marshall have surveyed all just about all the earthworks, so these geometric shapes. And they found out something very, very interesting. This here represents the Pyramid of Giza in Egypt. If the crown cap were on, from the base to the top, you'd have a distance of 606 feet. That's called a unit of measurement, which is known as the stade. S-T-A-D-E, the stade. This stade measurement, this 606, is found in all the megalithic sites from Egypt all the way up to England and Ireland. Megalithic sites. Big stone. 606. And also, they found, and as you well know, Egyptians had many failures, but until they got this one right, the angle is 51.8 degrees. Okay? Next slide. The Egyptians, because of that measurement, they knew the circumference of the earth. One-tenth of a nautical mile is 606 feet. On the surface of the earth, if you take that 1 minute of latitude arc, you've got 6,060 feet, or one nautical mile. This is how the Egyptians knew the circumference of the earth, that unit of measurement, the stade, 606. Next slide. Here is that octagon and circle enclosure at Newark, Ohio. This is called squaring the circle. You square the circle in this manner. And here's what they found out, 606 foot to the center, 606 foot, all division, the math is here. And right here, this is the further northernmost part of the rise of the moon, and right here is true north, and this angle is set at 51.8 degrees. The math of the Egyptians is in the math of Ohio, of the geometric works. They have the same unit of measurement. Very interesting. Next one. This is that same earthworks. This is Chillicothe. This is a distance of 60 miles. About 1997, it was published in Archaeology Magazine. Bradley Lepper, who is an archaeologist in the state of Ohio, they found bits and pieces of the Stone Highway just scattered across the state. When they surveyed it and took their aerial photos, they found out that the highway used to go from Newark, 60-mile distance, to Chillicothe. And when they further found out that this thing was walled, earth-bermed on both sides, and ran the whole length, which means if people were under attack in Newark, they could run this highway inside of a walled structure with fortifications along the way, all the way to Chillicothe, 60 miles distance. This road right now, they've got a piece of it in Lancaster County right here that's going to be preserved, and it's undergoing right now preservation. It'll be open to the public probably another 5 years. This highway isn't just a dirt road. It's cement, layers of stone and gravel. It's very, very unique. And it's causing a real buzz in Ohio because they're thinking that this road may even predate the roads that are in Mexico. That's what's coming up in the future. So, next one. 2 Nephi 5, 15 and 16. How am I doing on time? Oh, boy. And I did teach my people to build buildings and to work in all manner of wood, of iron, of copper, and of brass, steel, gold, and silver, and of precious ores, which were in great abundance. And I, Nephi, did build a temple, and I did construct it after the manner of the temple of Solomon, save it were not built with so many precious things, for they are not to be found upon the land. Wherefore, it could not be built like unto Solomon's temple, but the manner of construction was like unto the temple of Solomon, and the workmanship there was exceedingly fine. Okay, let's have a look. Next one. This is the temple of Solomon. The only thing I can compare it to on the lines here is the rectangular shape. A rectangular shape. These are the lines of the temple of Solomon. Next one. This is not a Nephite temple. This is a pyramid. This is the Mayan culture. The Mayan culture reached their classical period 300 to 500 AD. You don't go through classical construction of great magnitude when you have a war of genocide taking place in your land. It just doesn't happen. You go there today, you find the stela standing next to these pyramids, which can be read. It lists the names of the kings coming and going, their events, the next cities next door, and yet in the Book of Mormon it tells us if the Levites got the records, they would what? Destroy them. But yet we have these records. They're still here. I cannot imagine that Lehi and Nephi would come to America, a promised land, and pattern the temple of the Lord after an idolatrous structure, which this is, one of blood sacrifice, and even use the architecture of the Egyptians in doing that. It just makes reason stare. Next slide. John Fetzer Sr. was the architect for the Idaho Falls Temple. When he was assigned this task, he was greatly humbled by the brethren. He went and fasted and prayed, and it's written in a book by David Groberg, tells his story. After he fasted and prayed, he had a vision because he asked the Lord to direct him on how to construct this temple. He was given, by his own words, a vision of a Nephite temple. And thus, we have the Idaho Falls Temple. It's patterned after, according to him, a Nephite temple of the Book of Mormon time. Idaho Falls Temple. Rectangular construction. Next. In the state of Michigan, and I can't get into this because we don't have the time, there's lots of plates that were found, and on these plates we have very, very special buildings. This is just one of them, all rectangular construction. This symbol here is extremely important. We believe these are temples of these people. Next one, please. Here's the one. This one is very, look at this one, very, very rectangular, very special building, and we know it's special again because of this symbol right here, which we talk about, but I can't cover it today. We don't have time. Next one. Okay, Mosiah 2 and 7. Now, the Hopewell, for the multitude being so great that King Benjamin could not teach them all within the walls of the temple, therefore he caused a tower to be erected, that thereby his people might hear the words which he should speak unto them. Now, here we have, in the Book of Mormon, we know their temple, wherever it was built, they had walls around the temple. Let's take a look at Hopewell Temple compounds. This is a Hopewell Temple compounds. It exists from Missouri all the way through Ohio into Pennsylvania. Temple platform, they run 10 to 15 feet in height. The archaeologists have found post molds that had a wooden structure standing at one time, but we don't know what it looked like. And here again is the earth berms. This is the berm, and outside here it had a ditch to go around it. The city, these things are always built usually outside of the city area. This one here, Cedar Earth Banks, the city is all over in this direction. And this right here is on the river. This is a Hopewell Temple enclosure. Very, very much like, I believe, a Nephite temple enclosure. Next one. Here's what one actually looks like. This is in Havana, Illinois. This is a 2-acre by 2-acre platform. Today it's been turned into the city park. It's got the slides on, the sleds, and then you have the band shell and the flags up there and the whole nine yards. Very, very interesting. At Havana, when the Europeans first started selling this part of Illinois, There were a lot of Native Americans here, and there's a huge burial ground here of over 130-some mounds around this big one. And they asked them who constructed the mounds, and they said, well, we didn't do that. There was a people here long before us that constructed this mound. And their chief used to gather everybody together often. And there'd be so many people here, they had to build some kind of a platform to stand on to address his people from this temple mound. That's why to this day, in Havana, Illinois, this is called Speaker's Mound. Hopewell Temple Mound. Speaker's Mound. Next one. Everybody wants to know the narrow neck. I'll tell you what, guys. Book of Mormon geography, I don't think in our lifetime or anybody's lifetime is ever going to be solved, but I'll just give you a couple plugs of my best shot. My best shot is right here, good old Ether. The key here is the word sea. It's singular. You go down to Panama, you've got how many seas down there dividing the land? On both sides. You've got two seas, and the sea does not divide the land. It's on both sides of the bank. When I ask the Native Americans, which I run with quite a few, in Wisconsin, where does the sea divide the land? They have one word, Niagara. Niagara. The narrow neck. Next one, please. Here's Niagara. Lake Ontario, we call it a lake. Lake Erie, we call this a lake. But to them, it's all one body of water. Where does the sea divide the land? The sea divides the land at Niagara, which we call the Niagara River. Sea divides land. Narrow neck, Hill Cumorah sitting right here. Here's the narrow neck. Now, some people think, well, hey, this is only a lake. You can't call that a sea. Right? You're thinking that, aren't you? Okay. Who came to this country? What country did they come from? Israel. And what do they call the Dead Sea? The Dead Sea. How big is the Dead Sea compared to Lake Ontario? It's one-tenth the size. One-tenth. So in their eyes, this would still be called a sea. Okay? Just want to make sure we get that objection out of the way. All right. Next one. This stuff is brand new. I just pulled this out about last 4 weeks and had to do a quick slide shot. This is my roadmap in my car, and apologize, I don't have a better slide for you. Obviously, this is the state of Illinois you're looking at here. Keep in mind, 3rd Nephi, it's about 12, 14 years after Christ has come and gone. The Gadiantans are extremely strong. The Lamanites, the Nephites have to band together for their own protection. And it says that they gathered the land of Zarahemla, but they gathered into the wilderness to the south of Zarahemla. And then it says they gathered in the center of the land, and they fortified themselves. And they left the cities to the north and to the south desolate. So the Gadians come through and try to get their food and plunder, and there was nothing to gather. Anyway, make a long story short, in the state of Illinois, right down here, there's a stone wall that goes all the way across. All the way across. This whole bottom little point here of Illinois is called Little Egypt this day. You drive down there and you'll see the Little Egypt Hospital, Little Egypt this, Little Egypt that. The people here found artifacts that do not fit, quote, Native American type artifacts. They have a Mesopotamian or a Mediterranean flavor. And so they call this Little Egypt. The stone wall is real. Unfortunately, most of it is gone, but there's enough of it that can be traced all the way across. So the pioneers tore the wall down and used it for their fireplaces and sidewalks and foundations and, well, you name it. There's not much of it left. I got one picture here, and this wall is pretty poor. But there's little pieces like this that extend all the way across the state of Illinois. So I ask you, think about that. Just keep an open mind. You've got the Ohio on your east. You got the Mississippi on your left, forming the point, inverted triangle, and you got a stone wall all the way across. Center of the land, what a great place to sit down and wait this thing out with the Gadiantans. And I'm just making a suggestion, that's all. Something to look at for the future. Next one, please. This is a typical artifact, comes out of Little Egypt. Notice the skull cap, notice the menorah, notice the Star of David. This is Southern Illinois. Next one. Southern Illinois, people. Whoever this guy is being crucified, he got crucified in the wrist. Here's a tomb. How many days in the tomb? One, two, three sons. This up here is that special symbol, which I don't have time to get into. And here he is. I believe he's resurrected, and there's a whole story there, but I can't go into that. How's my time, guys? What do we have? 15 minutes. Okay, let's go. We got to get going here. This is a silver tablet found in Mill Valley, Utah, right here, not far from Salt Lake. It's cuneiform. Again, showing that this early language was here in the Americas. This is found right here just outside of Salt Lake City, cuneiform. Next one. This is the Bat Creek tablet. When this was first found, it was placed on display in the Smithsonian. It was placed upside down. Let's have the next one. It's a drawing. You can see it better. This is the right side up. It was placed upside down. The people at the Smithsonian thought, well, maybe this is the syllabusy of the Cherokee. They talk about the famous Cherokee written language. Well, they took it down on display, put it away in the basement. The night watchman happened to be a Jewish fellow, and he was a janitor. He happened to bump the table. This thing fell over. He picked it up this way, and he says, oh, my gosh. He says, I can read this thing. This says, for the land of Judah. And now today, this is on display in the Smithsonian, in its right place, that says, for the land of Judah. This was removed by Smithsonian archaeologists under controlled conditions in the state of Tennessee, Bat Creek. Next one. 1885. This is the Ohio Decalogue stone. This also was found under a large stone mound. It took over 1,000 wagon loads to carry the stone pile away. It was used for a dam and a mill and to riffraff a lake and a river. It's called the Ohio Decalogue. It has three letters above the image. It says Moshe in Hebrew, which is Moshe means Moses. This whole thing is totally readable. It's on display at the Johnson Humrick House Museum in Coshocton, Ohio. And it's absolutely beautiful. It was found by 9 men all at the same time underneath this huge mound that took them months to tear down, just about 2.5 miles from the city of Newark, the Newark site. This is the Ohio Decalogue stone. It was also found inside of a stone box. You can see the corner of it here on each side. And it's here again, it's an anomalous object. You say, well, there's no way the Indians had Hebrew, so therefore, well, maybe it's fake, but yet it stands the test to be authenticated. It's a real, genuine artifact, and you can go see it. It's about 12 inches. 12 inches. What it really is a Hebrew phylactery, which you can't probably see too well, but right down here, there's a place for a belt to slip through the bottom, and you hold that thing in your left hand. There's actually an imprint of wear here for your thumb. So you hold it in your hand like this, the belt wraps all the way down up to your shoulder, and you hold the Torah in your right arm. They still do that today. It's called a prayer stone. Hebrew phylactery, prayer stone. Next. In Alma 15:15, somewhere, the Book of Mormon lands, wherever they went up by the waters in the Northlands, and they built a city to honor Father Lehi. And they said, all it says in the Book of Mormon is they built it in a particular manner. Well, the archaeologists saw this, and the guys that surveyed all the sites in Ohio, and this thing sticks out like a sore thumb because there's nothing else like it. Oil lamp on the top, Hebrew menorah on the inside. I give you maybe the city of Alma. I don't know. Can't tell. Next one. How many people here have been to the temple? Show of hands. Okay. For those of you that haven't, this won't make any sense to you, so I'm sorry. This is published by the American Indian by Haynes, 1888. This fellow here recognized the Hebrew dialect and allowed the Algonquin tongue, the Algonquins of Newark State. Here's the Indian list, here's the English, here's the Hebrew. For God in English, the Indian of New York would say El. In Hebrew, it's El or Elim. To pray by the Algonquins of New York, Pele. Pelak in Hebrew. So you want to pray in Algonquin in New York today, it's Pele El. Okay? Next one. That's all I'm going to say about that. The Atlantic Monthly, the diffusionists have landed. How many people here know that they're diffusionists? Do you read the Book of Mormon? Yes? You're diffusionists, if you do. Diffusionist simply means that you believe there's cultures here in America prior to Columbus. This came out in January of 2000, and the best news about this is that Vine Deloria Jr., who is an Algonquin, spoke in this magazine. You can go to your library and pick it up. In here he states, at an archaeological conference, where the Algonquin family came from. He said, we crossed the Atlantic Ocean in boats. We sailed into the St. Lawrence Seaway. We sailed into the Great Lakes of North America, and we set in America from the center outward. And the Algonquin family is the basic stump of all the tribes east of the Mississippi River. This is the stump. Algonquin. St. Lawrence Seaway. Okay, next one. Tracing your genetic roots. January. This is 2002. This one came out. They just happened to select Algonquin people on the Great Lakes to check out their DNA. Next one, please. Here it is, right out of the page. Wallace's newest and most surprising discovery is a set of genetic markers found only in the Ojibwa. Ojibwa is a tribe of the Algonquin, or we call them Chippewa by our English, and the other tribes living near the Great Lakes. The markers are not found in any other Native Americans or in Asia. We just don't know how it got there, Wallace says, but it's clearly related to the European population. Simple answer would be that DNA arrived with the European colonists, but the strain is different enough from the existing European lineage that it must have left the old world long before Columbus. And then they go on to surmise, etc., etc., etc. These are not my words. This is our scientific community. This is happening right now, today. Next. But behold, this land, said God, shall be a land of thine inheritance, and the Gentiles shall be blessed upon the land, and this land shall be a land of liberty unto the Gentiles. And there shall be no kings upon the land who shall raise up unto the Gentiles, and I will fortify this land against all other nations. I ask you, where is that land? Are you afraid? It's America. Next one. Wherefore the remnant of the house of Joseph shall be built upon this land, and it shall be a land of their inheritance, and they shall build up a holy city unto the Lord, like unto Jerusalem of old. They shall no more be confounded until the end come, when the earth shall pass. Next one, please. Where's that special city? Yea, the word of the Lord concerning his church established in the last days for restoration of his people, as he has spoken by the mouth of his prophets, and for the gathering of his saints to stand upon Mount Zion, which shall be the city of New Jerusalem. Which city shall be built, beginning at the temple lot, which is appointed at the finger of the Lord in the western borders of the state of Missouri and dedicated by the hand of Joseph Smith, Jr., and others with whom the Lord was well pleased. DNC 84. Okay, this land. Next one. This is the cover of our book. If you like what's here today, this is where you get the information. And believe me, I've only given you a tip of the iceberg. There is so much more. I wish I could share it with you. I'm at the end of my time, and I appreciate that. Okay? Lights.
Whoa, okay, what do I say? I didn't bring any slides. I've known Wayne some time, and I'm very impressed with the work he's been doing. I took 25 years to write my book on the white God of ancient America, so I know what he's gone through, and it's a tremendous endeavor, and very exhausting, but exciting at the same time. From the first appearance of the Book of Mormon, of course, many theories have been proposed as to where it might have occurred. And geography is a fascination for many people. In the early days, Orson Hyde proposed that it was the whole two continents, and that Darien Straits or Panama was the narrow neck of land, of course, dividing the two oceans. But here you don't have a water dividing two lands, is the difference, as Wayne pointed out. Well, that was too big. It takes too long to go from South America up to Palmyra. I've walked through jungles, and it can take days to just go a few miles through some of those jungles, so that didn't work. It was reported that Joseph Smith said, tell me when about 12 minutes is up, would you, because otherwise I'll go on. That Joseph Smith reported that Lehi landed 30 degrees south in Chile, but that was found on a paper written by Frederick Williams, and there's no evidence that Joseph ever really said that. The Times and Seasons said that it was just below Darien, about 3,000 miles north of Chile. The Times and Seasons was under Joseph Smith's editorship, and so it's claimed that, therefore, he must have approved of this. It also said that Stevens and Catherwood had found, they'd been exploring the Mayan lands of Yucatan, and they found Quirigua, a very fascinating a little city. And so he said, well, that's either Zarahemla or very near Zarahemla. Now, whether he spoke out of revelation or exuberance, we would suspect probably exuberance, because he had been in jail for 6 months and was not in charge of the Times and Seasons at that time. So we're not sure who said that for him. Orson Pratt accepted Chile. He thought the Jaredites came on the west coast in North America. The Mulekites came to Panama, and the Nephites in South America. So we see a lot of theories here. John Sorensen of Farms has come up with 70 different theories on where the Book of Mormon may have occurred. And each one seems quite logical, and each one has its argument that is quite acceptable. Most of them seem to be in Central America, because that's where most of the archaeologists do their work. Why? Because there are more motels there. It's closer to get there. And there's some big buildings there that are very impressive, and so it's kind of fun to work there. It's not fun to dig in the earth and just find little teeny things for most people. It's pretty well accepted that wherever this happened, it has to fit the text quite closely, and Sorensen has come up with some 70 possibilities there, or 70 requirements that must be fulfilled in order to be a proof that this is where it actually occurred. Like geological locations and descriptions, which Wayne has gone over, travel distances must fit. You can't take a 600-mile stretch and say we traveled for a day and a half and got there. Flora and fauna, we have to find wheat, we have to find the cow, the ox, the axe, the ass, goats, elephants, horses. Now, we may never find all of these things, but these are at least in the Book of Mormon. Objects like chariots, wheels, gold, silver, all of these metals, elegant, spacious buildings and temples, rich clothing, extensive system of roads, towers, cement, gold plates. All of this has to be found if we're going to prove that this area was the Book of Mormon area. It's very easy to just take one and say, hey, gold has been found here, therefore this is Book of Mormon lands. No, you got to cover the whole list. You can't just stress one or two. And even some beliefs and practices, as been pointed out, Kevin Christensen pointed out to me, that there weren't many Israelites who came over here, so we can't expect the whole area of North, Central, and South America to suddenly have Israelite ideas. And so we're going to have to look for those, or maybe not even find them at all. Writing, of course, is a very important one. And just writing on a stone glyph doesn't answer the question of writing, because they wrote on plates. Well, May and Gobel have done a tremendous amount of research. I've read Wayne's book, and I've even endorsed it as a very important book to study if you're going to look for Book of Mormon places. I didn't say that he's got it right on and that's it and now we've got the answer, but he certainly has given us something to think about. He's not the only one. Dwayne Erickson, the Garths, McGavin and Bean, Phyllis Olive and others, also Delbert Curtis, have suggested the Palmyra area. But Wayne has put it all together in a very palatable way, and I'd suggest you read it. The strength of Wayne's proposal and his book, of course, the Palmyra area is a known. That's one thing we do know, we think. Some people believe maybe the hill was somewhere down in Guatemala and then moved up to Palmyra. So geography with the seas seems to work pretty well, as Wayne has spelled it out. The large mounds and fortresses are very impressive. I have to admit that. They really are impressive. The artifacts found in southern Illinois, he didn't tell you much about that, and I don't have time to, but a cave has been found there with thousands of these faces with beards that are not Indian at all, and Wayne is working on that. And I think when he gets his way and finds what he wants, he's going to shock a lot of archaeologists across the country who think that the Monroe Doctrine was in effect and nobody was ever allowed into the Americas at any time. That's going to change, I think. Of course, metals, copper mines are very effective. So he's answered a lot of the questions. There are still many questions yet to be answered, I believe, that Wayne may want to work on, or maybe he's getting tired of working on this. It doesn't sound like it, though. And let someone else do it. To me, the most obvious missing are the cities. Now, mounds are not cities. Mounds around areas are not especially cities, although they could be. But if they are, then where are the remains of these cities? Any city in Central America and South America that are 2,000 to 3,000 years old have remains. We see foundations of houses. We see the post holes where they put their houses, not just their mounds. We find objects that they used every day. They had dump yards where they dumped their refuse, and we can find those. And I think one problem that many people have when they try to find Book of Mormon lands, they make a map of where the houses of the cities were, and then they just plop it down on some map and assume that the cities are there. We've got to show them. Schliemann, remember, people didn't think Troy existed. He finally found Troy. He found the remains of Troy, and so we can say, yes, there was a Troy. Up to that point, it was just speculation. So I think we need to show more of cities and houses and living quarters. We've shown a lot where people died, where they buried their dead, but let's find out where they lived. That's also important. I'm not so sure Israelites built temples on burial mounds or on any mounds at all. As Wayne pointed out, they didn't come over here and build their temples on top of pyramids. And so I want to see some remains of these magnificent temples that were like Solomon's temple although not as great. It's strange to me. He points out all the Nephi points out all the gold, silver, all the beautiful metals they had, and then he says, but we didn't have as much as they did over in Israel, so we couldn't build our temples as much or as well or on the same level. That seems like a contradiction. We still need to find the bones of cows, oxen, goats, horses, elephants. Mammoths do not solve that problem. Mammoths died out thousands of years before Book of Mormon times, and those people probably didn't even know about them. We didn't know about dinosaurs until the 1800s. People lived before that and didn't even know such things existed. So large bones were found, and they assumed those were people. So we need to find those. What are Qumrans and Qumrans? We don't know. Why, if it happened around the Palmyra area or Ohio, do we not hear about buffaloes? But what would they call them? I don't know what they would call them. Maybe a Qumran, but then what's a Qumran? I don't know. Pardon me? Well, if they did, where are the bones of the elephants? I see. Okay, well, they didn't write it in the Book of Mormon, so we don't know. Writings on metal plates, we don't find that up in North America, as far as I know. And I don't know that the Nephites wrote on stone. Networks of roads, yes, Wayne has shown some roads, but if they had cities all the way from Cumorah all the way to Zarahemla, there must have been a lot of roads connecting those cities, so we still need to find a few more roads, perhaps. A few other questions. Let's see. If all the Nephites were destroyed 400 A.D., and I just wrote a lot of notes as Wayne was talking here, who's building fortresses up to 500 A.D.? And if most of the fortresses were built during the time of Christ up to 200 A.D. during the time of peace, why were they building fortresses during a time of peace? That is just a question in my mind. The Book of Mormon has the sea, east and west sea, divided from the land of Zarahemla south of Bountiful by a narrow strip of wilderness, or a narrow strip of a narrow strip by the river Sidon. In his book, I think, Wayne, you have Zarahemla up near that area at one point, and then at another you have it over by the river Sidon, right?
It would be DNC 125. Joseph was suggested to build a new city across from Nauvoo and name it Zarahemla.
Yeah.
And he placed it there because after he left on the march and planned camp, he goes into Huntsville, Randolph County, Missouri, and said this is the location for the city of Manti.
Right.
So we know Zarahemla had an enormous land.
But the Book of Mormon talks about it being near the land of Bountiful, near the narrow neck, somewhere near the narrow neck, and that's about a 900 to 1,000 mile trip from Niagara over to Ohio, where you have Zarahemla. That's quite a trip. I just wonder how to work that one out. Also, if Zarahemla were, the original Zarahemla, near Niagara, and the river Sidon is the Mississippi, you have to carry your bodies over 1,000 miles to dump them in the river. That would be like us carrying our dead bodies down to Texas to dump them in the Rio Grande. It just seems like a little far to dump your bodies. I don't know. I'm just asking questions.
How does Hagar come into this?
Pardon me?
Hagar building a boat in the sea west to get to the northern country.
Go ahead, Wayne.
Well, I called the Great Lakes. So I
want to make sure you record it here for the. You want to repeat.
How does Higloth then building the boats fit into this configuration of geography? Sure, go ahead.
We just figured the Great Lakes has a total one body of water because of the singularity of Ether's statement. The sea divides the land. The Great Lakes are one body of water, and so if you set sail on the West Sea, that would have been the Great Lakes.
Well, they could have walked around too. They didn't have to.
Well, I don't know. It's he set sail. So, I mean, he's sailing in a boat. He's sailing in the West Sea, heading in an easterly direction. Okay?
Okay, thank you. Just a couple more, and then we'll open it up to questions. What do I have? A couple of minutes? All right, we better hurry up here. One thing I really wonder, Brigham Young says the Gadianton robbers were hiding out in the Rocky Mountains. And if Zarahemla is over by the Mississippi, that's quite a ways to make a night raid. I don't quite know how they worked that out. So there's some questions to be answered there. Let's see. I had some more notes. I've got them all over the place. I'm still not sure about this DNA because I've heard people talk about no DNA from anywhere but Asia, and you're saying that they have an article where they have found other DNA. Yeah, so I don't know.
100%
of the male
has come out of Spain, Europe,
Spain.
I know
you
said Europe, but Europe, not the Middle East.
Okay. Now, here's a man who knows DNA, right? We all have some.
99% of the women, the mitochondria DNA, are
Southern Asia. There may be a pocket we haven't discovered yet, of course.
Well, yeah, because they study every Indian tribe in North, Central, and South.
Right.
Including BYU. They just don't.
Even the Indians at BYU.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So they've done a lot of work in Chile. They've
yeah.
3,000
Okay, well, we'll have to leave that one for another time. I'm wondering about the time periods. I've read a lot about the Adena and the Hopewell, and every book I read is a little different. Some of them have them up to 1000 BC, which doesn't help us with the arrival of Lehi at 500 BC. And then they overlap the Hopewell and the Adena in some books. Others say the Adena stops 200 AD and then the Hopewell takes over. So I'm a little confused about all that, how it fits in. And I'm also wondering, why must we turn our North American Indians into Israelites and Nephites and Lamanites? Can't they just be North American Indians? We know that people were on these continents for 14,000 to 20,000 years, and they had a long time to develop these cultures. When the people from the Book of Mormon arrived here, there must have been a great civilization all over these continents. I mean, evidence supports that. Unfortunately, many Mormons who haven't read about it think that the Book of Mormon is the only civilization that was here. That would be like saying that Israel was barren when Moses and his people arrived and they were the only ones who ever lived in Israel. Or like saying that Israel or the Bible is the story of Europe and that there were no other Europeans anywhere else, that this is a whole story. I think it's the same thing in Book of Mormon. We had a lot of people living here. And when we deal with any one area, then what do we do with all the other areas, all the great civilizations in Central and South America? Why does the Book of Mormon never mention those? We don't know. Why does it avoid some of the great cities like Teotihuacan that had an influence even up in North America and South America, had over 200,000 inhabitants living there, and plenty of remains of that city? Why are those cities still there? Book of Mormon cities have all disappeared. I don't. Just a question again. I've been in a lot of shacks and in the jungles of Guatemala and South America, and these American Native Indians down there have radios, some of them have televisions, some of them have light bulbs, but that doesn't prove that they're the ones who invented those things or that they descended from those people. And I think we have to be careful about finding artifacts and then assuming that those artifacts identify the people who created them always. Just another question. Well, there are a lot of other questions I would like to ask. I don't really have time to do that, and I'm sure you will like to ask a lot of questions. Again, I want to congratulate Wayne on doing a lot of work here, prodigious work, and there's a lot more, of course, to be done. The adventure is not over, and when I finished my book, and I've been, like you said, I've been to 250 different sites. I've studied most of these theories. They all sound good to me, and they all have holes. And it's kind of like trying to fit a very heavy 40-year-old lady into her 20-year-old wedding dress. A lot of pushing and pulling and stretching has been done to try to make these theories fit. And I think the Lord is letting us have some fun. I hate to look for the day when it's all solved and we have all the answers and now we can move on to something else. This is a fun area. And a lot's coming out, and I really enjoy it. So the adventure isn't over. And somebody once said to me, when I was so sure that I had all the answers in my book on the white-bearded God, and hand me that, please. That, right there by your hand.
Oh, right there.
Many people say, well, there are legends of the white God here. Therefore, Christ had to come here, and therefore this is Book of Mormon lands. Let me show you where the legends of the Book of Mormon are. This is just a chart out of my book. I found hundreds of legends of the white-bearded God all over the Americas. And the strongest legends are in Central America and South America. There are some really nice ones up around the Palmyra area, too. But they're everywhere. And there are different times. There are too many of them in too many different times, and you'd have to read my book to find out what I say about it. But it's out of print, and Crowder says he's going to print it again, but wait a few months. So I don't know. Anyway, the advice given to me when I was so sure I had all the answers was avoid the temptation to turn your visions, your revelations, and your experiments into conclusions. So I'm trying to learn to do that and just sit back and let it happen. Thank you.
Okay, we're ready for questions, and we want to record your questions. So if I can get you to come up here to speak into the microphone, or we'll try to repeat it if you can make it very short, and I hope you will keep them short. Wayne, I assume most of them will be addressed to you, so why don't you come up here and repeat the question when it's asked, all right?
I'm intrigued that it's serious that the Book of Mormon took place in that area. I'm not aware of any quotes in the Book of Mormon that relate to snow, blizzards, people freezing, and somewhere I would think that would have to be addressed.
Well, the issue of weather, there's really not much weather mentioned at all. The idea of weather, extreme conditions of weather, snow, ice, that kind of thing being mentioned, it's not in the Book of Mormon. And I know one place Nephi compares something to snow, so he knew what snow was. He compares it to the whiteness of something. I don't remember the scripture offhand, but it is in there if you get a concordance. So he knew what it was, but a lot of the weather is left out in the Book of Mormon. I mean, really, all over. And they also mention seasons. So what kind of seasons? You know, I don't know. It's not real clear. So I really can't say much. Yes, sir.
Along this line, fish is not mentioned, and the Native Americans certainly around the lakes and by the rivers live by fish.
Well, let's explore that a little bit. Okay, he says the word fish or fish as a food, I guess, is what you're referring to, is not mentioned. Native American, the Algonquin tongue, the river of Mississippi is known as Namimisu. Namimisu means river of fish. In the Book of Mormon, it's called Sidon. If that is Sidon, Sidon is an Egyptian word, which also means fish. And that's the only thing I can give you back on fish. Anybody else? Yes, Richard.
Does the geography issue get clouded when you bring in the tremendous geological upheaval that happened in North and South America at the time of the crucifixion? Does that skewer your observations?
Okay, the geography issue, as I mentioned, he wants to know if that changes things. Well, yeah, it does. I hate to even bring it up. You have to address it. You notice I hesitate about the narrow neck. I'm not totally convinced that is the narrow neck, only because I really believe that North America was really messed up big time at the crucifixion. There were some major, tremendous changes. We know for a fact that the Great Lakes, for example, half of Ohio was underwater before that time. So, I mean, what the Great Lakes actually looked like before the crucifixion is anybody's guess. There's a lot of changes. I'm trying to stay on two things. Number one, I'm trying to follow what Joseph's statements are, and I'm trying to stay close to the data of the Hopewell and Dena culture. Those are my guides. Now, where it falls, that's where it falls. Joseph says, this is where Zelph is. He says, in Missouri, this is where Manti is, in Randolph County. If that's the case, well, then Zarahemla has got to be somewhere north of there. The Gadanton robbers, Terry's comment about night raids, they encircled the entire land, north and south, and populated the cities, which were left bare by the Nephites. It wasn't just simply a night raid. And again, metal plates, there are metal plates. They belong to a collection called Soper Savage. The Soper Savage has a terrible reputation. The whole thing was debunked. But if you look at it closely, which I normally go through a two-hour presentation, I show you the Michigan plates. That's a whole other game. We have 1,500 pieces here in Salt Lake City in the warehouse, four blocks off Temple Square. That whole collection is not on display. I've been doing my best to try to get it out on display so that you can see these things for yourself. Yes, sir. Right. Yes.
Are there any thoughts you have about geography, about the Nephites coming out here in the west?
Well, the question is about Moroni and coming out into the west in the Utah area. And my first question is, to me, that would make perfect sense. If everything ended up in New York, the great battles and the wars still continued because the Lamanites fought amongst themselves, Moroni had to go somewhere because he was gone for, 20, 30-some years. He was absent. And then he comes back to the Hill Cumorah. So he had to get out of that area that was under tremendous warfare. Had he stayed in that area, he probably would have been discovered and put to death. But he went away from there. He went someplace where all this was not happening. He came out to Utah. Okay? Yes, sir?
Just regarding the writing sample, like the back, are there other writing samples from the same time period found? And if so, like what's the percentage of? I mean, you know, like if this were the only writing, it would be quite convincing. But if, you know, say 99% of the writing is in some other language entirely, it would be up.
On this continent, they find the cuneiform, they find Paleo-Hebrew, they find Assyrian, they find a script that is not identified, they find Phoenician. And work which is unfortunately not published by Glade Bergen, who lives in Farmington, Utah. He did his doctorate on it at BYU in 1970 or 71. I have a copy of his thesis. He took all these languages that have been found throughout North America, compared them all, looking for similarities of script. He found over a 64% match. And in his eyes, he said, this stuff cannot be fake. It has to be real. It's got to have a hardcore base of some type.
Well, yeah, but what I'm wondering is, like, are there other writings in non-Hebraic or whatever languages from the same area, from the same time period?
Well, non-Hebraic, I mean, I... Are there other languages that are non-Hebraic from the same time period?
In a particular geographical location you're looking at from that time period, like, if you're claiming that certain, you know, like the Bactrians don't indicate Hebrew languages or whatever, are there also non-Hebrew-type writings from that same group of people in the same area?
I don't know if I can answer that. I don't have an answer for you there. Okay? Yes?
I think our brief discussion might address this question.
Go ahead.
Do you want to come up and...
Yeah.
The brother of Jared probably wrote in cuneiform. And some of the records that he found are cuneiform and Akkadian. And when the languages were confounded, he obviously took his language, and the languages spread out, Egyptian, Akkadian, and what have you. He wrote on his cuneiform tablets his vision. He had to bring it to America. This fellow has the best evidence to support the fact that the Jaredites came up the St. Lawrence River, and that's where they landed, and this is where all the evidence is of the Jaredites, and then the hill Ramah connects them with the Nephites. So it's a fascinating study.
That would have you would have seen that information had we had another hour, because it's a whole different slide program. I usually run a 2-hour show, but yes, sir.
The genetic problem that you used the U.S. News article. Actually, that article is talking about something called haplogroup X. Could you explain to us how haplogroup X supports? I don't understand. You made it sound like
all I'm
okay. Support the Book of Mormon claims, and so I'm asking you, would you please explain how that?
He's asking how the genetic evidence from the magazine supports what he feels he realized here. The reason I show that is because I know from the BYU studies that they've not found stuff to support that in Mesoamerica. I'm simply showing that in here at least we have something different, whether it be European or Semitic or somebody. We have people coming to this land of a different stock.
But it doesn't actually support the Book of Mormon.
Well, I don't know if it does or not. I mean, what were the...
Directly.
And again, we have to ask yourself, what were the Jaredites? I mean, just because they came from the Tower of Babel, that doesn't mean they were this or that. We don't know what they were. Okay, Colette?
I was going to say, on the weather thing that you were talking about...
You're right here.
My field of study is ancient Britain, and people who have studied the weather patterns of ancient Britain, you're going to have on the same parallels across the earth from Britain to here, show that England was not always wet, cold, and awful, you know, the way we've got it from time to time. And that prior to Christ and before Solomon, you know, Solomon's ships went to England, if you want to call it England now. That was where you went and got tin, all right? So, and the weather people describing things is it was balmy. This was a warm place. and this was a place, a destination. It was wonderful. And they go into the weather that was in Scandinavia, and we think, okay, we've got all the icebergs, we've got the cold. No, they show that the people who came out, who are called the Indo-Europeans, who came in and up into Scandinavia and everything, that they did not trek through snow. They came in times when it was wonderful. And the same way with the same parallel in Alaska, when all the ice sheets keep falling off, what they find is the flora and fauna and animals of a tropical, very warm, lovely place to live. So you had a lot of things go on, you know, at the time of Christ and other times, but that same time period of Christ, when you had all that warm weather, and before that you've got the Nephites and things that are going on, you had a lovely climate, say, north of New York, you know, and as you went around that band. And people who are doing studies about it now show that a lot of things changed because there were meteorite showers and things like that that really changed what was going on in Europe and in that area. So you're not going to talk about people out there on snowmobiles in the Nephite times because they just didn't need them. That was wonderful weather up until everything took a hit.
Just the back.
I'm just wondering, when you showed the quote from Dean Jesse, and then Senator O'Brien talked about the, I know that Joseph Smith took John Lloyd Stevens excerpts from his book and published them in the Times and Seasons. Why the intellectual shift from, it seems like there's an intellectual shift from New York down to Central America, and that seems to be what takes precedence when, like in 1879 with Orson Pratt's publication of the Book of Mormon with the footnotes, and then George Reynolds in his Book of Mormon Geography, and then with Brigham Young Academy Expedition, the Central American, South American, seems to take
really
take hold. Why is it that we get away from the seeming revelation that Joseph Smith gives?
You
want to
answer that one, Jerry?
Summarize
well,
that question,
Terry. Yeah, let me put that in three words, huh? Like
you're right.
Yeah,
you're exactly right.
The question is, Joseph seemed to think, and so did others, and state that it all happened in Central America. Why have we shifted?
He referred to the quote about the land of the Nephites, Illinois.
The land of the Nephites was in Illinois, but see, he did think it was in Central America for a while, then he shifted to Illinois, and now we're back to Central America again. I think it's because of that list. We have 70 things on the list, and the majority of this seem to be in Central America. We've got the beautiful buildings, we've got the cement, we've got writing. A lot depends on and who has the fullest list, I guess, but no list is complete. I also want to say that oftentimes we'll say this is, we'll draw a conclusion, like the Moses stone. That's in my book too. And we don't know for sure that that was found under strict archaeological conditions, even though they were there. We're not sure but what the man planted it there before he helped them find it. Because in his home, the man who found that Moses stone was found a book on Hebrew, carving tools, and the same kind of stone that the stone was made of, the Moses stone was made of. So was he trying to learn to carve like the stone he'd found, or did he carve the stone he found?
I got an answer. Okay, good. That was Mr. Weyrich.
Mr.
Weyrich tried to make a replica of that stone, which he did complete. 34 errors were on his replica, which were messed up. If the guy created it the first time, he should have been able to master it the second time. Yes, sir. Yes.
Well, the Bat Creek stone and the Jewish Star of David. In the Maya area, they have found the Jewish Star of David too. But what they find, it is a symbol for day. There are two symbols for day that look like half of a Jewish Star of David. When you put them together upside down, they look like a Jewish star. They were never upside down until the archaeologists put them together. The Bat Creek. Let's see, Cyrus Gordon speaks about that extensively. He's the one, I think.
He's about the only one who believes
it. Right, and I talked to him about that, and he's convinced he's right. He said, why is it I was lauded about everything else I said about Europe, but as soon as I shifted to America and started talking about it, now I'm a kook. And he said, I don't do any excavating. I just walk around and look in everybody else's hole and find out what they're doing. That's what he told me.
The one scholar, he's the only one that really steps to the land of Judah. I understand his own colleagues, but it doesn't say that.
I've heard other translations of that too, Wayne. The Golden Age of the Jews, and then there are several other translations, so I don't know what to make of that.
That's an apocryphal question.
But it comes from about the late 1800s, before archaeology even began, so we don't know.
Yes, Spector?
I'll
make mine very clear.
Yeah.
What do I feel about Joseph Smith's position? I feel, personally, that as you read in the Book of Mormon, and when they mention this land, I really feel they're not talking about the whole Western Hemisphere. I feel they're talking about the United States of America. The land of liberty, land of no kings, the land of the New Jerusalem is going to be built. Okay? Here. Joseph. I also accept what Joseph's statements in his journals because, it's a roadmap, it's a path, it's something to begin with, to guide. I also accept the oral traditions of the Native Americans, which again is in my book. I haven't even touched on those today here. It's too much information, but it's there. Those are my guides, and where they lead me, and that's, if I've done both 2 hours, you'll realize that when I get done, I am not a two Kumara guy. In other words, I don't believe it took place in Mexico, and then Moroni walked up to New York State and buried that 50-pound or 60-pound box of tablets, okay? And I always ask my audiences when I'm finished, if the prophet put the word out today and said, okay, brothers and sisters, take your family, take your food storage, meet me at Cumorah. End of message. Where would you go? Mexico or New York? I'll be in New York.
Okay, Terry, I think that last question was directed to both of you, so we'll let you have the last word, and then we're out of time.
Well, I don't want the last word on this thing. But anyway, I have a friend who claims he has received a revelation about it all. I mean, we're talking theories, so might as well throw out another one. He says that he was told in this revelation, the Book of Mormon is true, that the people in the Book of Mormon are real people and that we will someday meet them, but that it all happened on a totally different plane, not on this earthly plane that we're trying to figure out. So work on that one. Sylvia.
Yes, Wayne
said that
the Book of Mormon said
the
man of
Jewish,
but we have to remember when he
came
here, there were no people here, so he was free.
Well, we don't believe there were no people here. There were thousands of people here. She's from Guatemala, and she's convinced that's where it happened.
But it's not only in Guatemala, I think America is the whole continent. When they came was in South America, Central America, and then in North America. So for me, it's on all the continents, not only one country.
Okay, there they have the answer.
Okay, thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Wayne.
Hey,
nice meeting you.
Thank you,
Terry.
Thank you.
Nice.
I had dark hair.